These men are Freemasons, members of a worldwide fraternity which unites working men in small towns with men of rank and opulence occupying the highest seats of power. Once public Masonic parades were commonplace, but this annual march by the Masons of Melrose in Scotland is probably the last in Britain. The march honours the stonemasons who built Melrose Abbey and gives local Freemasons a chance to parade their new lodge master around the town. But Britain's other 9,000 lodges meet behind closed doors, and the identity of most of Britain's half a million Masons is a closely guarded secret. It's estimated that of 135,000 serving policemen in Britain, 22,000, or one in six, are Freemasons. Most Masons say there is no conflict of interest between police work and membership of the Brotherhood, but some outsiders disagree.
What is certain, and I've seen the evidence for it and other people have seen it, that there are lists of lodges which include active criminals and serving policemen in the same lodge, and that can never be right.
Critics also worry that Masons are concentrated in many other powerful institutions, notably the law. Confidential Masonic documents reveal that hundreds of magistrates, at least 18 circuit judges, 4 Queen's Bench judges, 3 family division judges, 2 judges in Chancery, 3 Lord Justices of Appeal, and 1 Lord of Appeal are Masons. But it's in the City of London that the greatest concentration of Masons is found. For Britain's richest square mile, there are hundreds of Masonic lodges in which brothers from the great banks and insurance houses, the Stock Exchange, and all the other money markets meet in secret. Here at the Guildhall, from which the city is governed, Masons gather in the crypt for a meeting of the Guildhall Lodge. A past lodge master, Sir Kenneth Cork, is handed the briefcase containing his ceremonial apron by his chauffeur. The head of one of the city's most successful accountancy firms, specializing in company liquidations and bankruptcies, Sir Kenneth is also a former Lord Mayor of London. Since 1900, 70 London Lord Mayors have been masters of Guildhall Lodge, evidence of the high esteem in which Masons are held in Britain's traditional institutions. But have other Masons used the Brotherhood for corrupt ends, as even some Masons claim?
I think that people use Freemasonry or for the wrong purposes. They use it as a way to get on, to improve their position, to get promotion. And corrupt people use it to carry out their corruption in a secret manner, with very little chance of being caught.
Brother Junior Warden, there is a report.
Tonight, in the first of 6 programmes on the Brotherhood's power and influence, we investigate the secret ceremonial rituals of the ancient fraternity of free and accepted Masons, and show how its members have ranged from the highest to the lowest in British society, from kings to convicts.
Whom have you there?
Mr. Martin, a poor candidate in a state of darkness.
Filming the mysteries of Freemasonry is forbidden, so, using Masonic handbooks and helped by Master Masons, we have reconstructed the Brotherhood's rituals. Tonight, thousands of men all over Britain are performing these mystic rites.
Worshipful Master, Mr. Martin, a poor candidate in a state of darkness, who has been well and worthily recommended...
There are 3 degrees of initiation into basic craft Freemasonry. This is the first degree ritual in which the candidate seeks to become an apprentice Mason.
Do you, Brother Inner Guard, vouch that he has been properly prepared?
I do, Worshipful Master.
Then let him be admitted in due form. Brother Deacons.
Do you feel anything?
Yes.
Women are not allowed to become Masons. And some interpretations of the ritual say the candidate's left breast is exposed to prove that he is not a woman. His trouser leg is rolled up to show that he's able-bodied, and he is blindfolded because he is in a state of darkness seeking light. To non-Masons, these rituals might seem a strange pastime for grown men to indulge in. But psychologist Jane Furbank, who studied male bonding, believes that Freemasonry may satisfy a deeper need than other all-male groups.
Thus assured, I will thank you to kneel while the blessing of heaven is invoked on our proceedings.
On the purely practical level, it has the same need as joining the local chamber of commerce, the golf club and all the rest. But it does also give you what's called a rite of passage. It takes you in from being adolescent or from being what's technically called a peripheral male, one on the outside. Brings you into the centre, into the heart, where the power and the influence is.
That power and influence knows few bounds. The Palace of Westminster houses one of English Masonry's best-kept secrets, the existence of two lodges reserved for men who work in Parliament. One of these, the Gallery Lodge, was founded 100 years ago by pressmen and lobby correspondents. The other was created at the suggestion of the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VIII, an ardent Mason. In the 1920s, he was upset to learn Labour politicians were being blackballed when proposed as members of Masonic lodges. The craft stood to be condemned as the Tory party in aprons, and when Labour looked set to become the party of government, Masonry was in danger of losing all influence over Britain's future. The Prince suggested a new lodge to welcome Labour MPs and so draw them into both Masonry and the middle ground of British politics. The aptly named New Welcome Lodge was consecrated in 1929, and today it contains 20 past and present MPs from all leading parties. Yet it must tread a careful path if it's not to break one of the Brotherhood's loudly proclaimed rules.
Your obedience must be proved by a strict observance of our laws and regulations, by abstaining from every topic of political and religious discussion.
Despite this injunction against discussing politics within the Lodge, there is no rule against Masons interfering in politics outside the Lodge. In 1935, Masons played a crucial role in the election of a new leader of the Labour Party. Clement Attlee and one of his rivals for the leadership, Arthur Greenwood, were Masons, but a third candidate, Herbert Morrison, was not. In an interview filmed in 1965, but not broadcast, Morrison reflects on Freemasonry's damaging effect on his career.
Somebody who I do not know, anonymously, sent me a copy of a notice convening a Freemason's Lodge meeting. A few days, anything up to a week, I forget the exact lapse of time, before this meeting of the Parliamentary Party to decide upon the leadership. Then the anonymous writer suggested that the meeting of the Freemason's Lodge was to win support for Mr. Arthur Greenwood, who was known to be a Freemason and in fact was a very important officer of this lodge.
Yet as Freemason Robert Burns perhaps meant to say, even the best laid plans of Mason men can fail. Greenwood came third in the first ballot and was eliminated. In the runoff, the Masons switched their vote to Brother Attlee. This ensured the defeat of the non-Mason Morrison. So despite Freemasonry's claim never to interfere in politics, it seems the Brotherhood had a direct influence on one of the most important British political decisions this century.
Shows that the country is ready.
Worshipful Brother Attlee went on to become Prime Minister in 1945 and stayed Labour leader until 1955. Today, British Masons still occupy positions of political power. At least two cabinet ministers are members of the Brotherhood. Cecil Parkinson belongs to the Royal Athelstan Lodge and the Potter's Bar Lodge, which meets in his constituency. And Lord Belstead belongs to the exclusive Kaiser Ehind Lodge. He became leader of the House of Lords in 1988, succeeding another Mason, Viscount Whitelaw, who had been Mrs. Thatcher's Deputy Prime Minister. Former Health Minister Sir Gerard Vaughan and backbencher Neil Thorne are both grand officers of English Freemasonry. Many other MPs are Masons, including Cecil Walker, Ulster Unionist, Sir William Clarke, Anthony Nelson, Peter Rost, Tony Baldry, David Sumberg and Gary Waller, all Conservatives. Another Mason is the former MP and Solicitor General Sir Ian Percival, who says it's inconceivable that Masons would interfere in politics.
If anybody tried it, not only would they not succeed, but they wouldn't get as much as they would have got without doing it, if you know what I mean. I mean, they would be blacklisted. And not only by the rest of the House, they'd be blacklisted by the Masons in the House, because we don't want that reputation. And if anybody tries it, I can tell you we're very stern about it.
But some non-Mason MPs remain uneasy about the existence of a parliamentary lodge.
It's bringing together a subgroup within the House for various covert purposes from which the rest of us are excluded. Therefore, in a representative institution, it must, ipso facto, be undesirable.
Freemasons Hall, London, headquarters of the English craft. One man in every 30 in England and Wales is a Mason. In Scotland and Northern Ireland, the ratio is even higher. Their leaders always come from the top of the social pyramid. This century, three kings have been Masons. The Queen's father, George VI, was in the Navy Lodge. So was Prince Philip, but he quit many years ago. Today, England's chief Mason is the Queen's cousin, the worshipful Grand Master, the Duke of Kent.
I think it is probably true that many of the problems, if I can call them that, that Freemasonry has encountered in recent years, do stem from perhaps a misguided policy towards information.
As part of a new policy of openness, England's other Masonic bosses were filmed for the first time in 1988. The pro-Grand Master is Lord Cornwallis, 3rd Baron of Linton, a farmer and businessman. The assistant Grand Master is Lord Farnham, a merchant banker. And the deputy Grand Master is the Honourable Edward Baillieu, a retired stockbroker. Although many Masons are from what used to be called the working class, most are from the middle and upper classes. Professional men, lawyers, doctors, army officers, bank managers, and self-employed businessmen. Show business personalities like Alfred Marx, Mike Reed, and Bob Monkhouse are also on the square. All these men have been put through the ritual humiliation inflicted at each of the Brotherhood's first three degrees. They are therefore sworn to uphold three principles: brotherhood, relief or charity, and truth. But alongside these worthy principles, the Brotherhood has many disquieting features. Its membership is largely secret. The brothers have secret ways of making themselves known to each other, and they have sworn secret oaths of mutual aid. These are all hallmarks of a secret society, yet English Masonry's Grand Secretary, Michael Higham, rejects any sinister interpretation of the Order's secrecy.
We've got secrets. Secrets which derive from the old days when they were recognition signals between craftsmen protecting their trade secrets, and we still use them now as a link with the past. But we're absolutely not a secret society.
Nevertheless, among the public, the fear persists that there may be more to the secrets than harmless ritual. And when cameras were invited to film in Grand Lodge for the first time, not everything would be open for scrutiny. Journalist Paul Foote has long campaigned against what he sees as Freemasonry's sinister power.
To all the brethren who receive the most worshipful Pro-Grand Master.
It's the secrecy of the association and the bonds that they tie each other up with, which is the sinister aspect of it. Most of the other organisations which bring together important people in the community, I mean the Rotary Club or the Round Table or organisations of like that, they can be discovered, if you like, by someone like me or you. We can go and find out who's the chairman of the Round Table or who's the chairman of the Rotary Club, and they throw their meetings open to the public, and the press mingle with them and so on. Freemasonry, they mingle in secret.
Are you therefore willing to take a solemn obligation founded on the principles I have stated, to keep inviolate the secrets and mysteries of the order?
I am.
Then you will kneel on your left knee. Your right foot formed in a square. Give me your right hand, which I place on the volume of the sacred law, while your left will support these compasses. One point
presented to your naked left breast.
The impressionable apprentice Freemason undergoes a bizarre and powerful bonding. Nevertheless, many senior Masons dismiss concern about secret Masonic influence as an orchestrated campaign against the Brotherhood.
I think there is a small body of people who, for reasons that I don't understand, are not only not friendly, they are downright hostile. And the activists usually are the ones whose views get heard most, and they've been making quite a noise.
In 1988, in an attempt to confront growing public suspicion, the Freemasons produced a glossy video.
The spire of Salisbury Cathedral, 250 feet of soaring stone, rising above the water meadows of the Wiltshire Avon. The travelling stonemasons who built the great cathedrals of medieval Europe formed their own associations, apart from the rest of the medieval guild system.
For all its apparent openness, the commercially produced video is a careful exercise in concealment. Even the legend that modern Freemasons are descended from medieval stoneworkers is left virtually intact. But there is little historical evidence for this, as Masonic historian John Hamill confirms.
When people were first starting to put Masonic histories together, the tradition grew up that we grew directly out of the stonemasons, and I mean, traditions die very hard, particularly in this country. And it's taken a lot of time to break that down and say, well, look, that's fine, it's a nice story, but is the evidence there for it?
Most evidence indicates that ritualistic Freemasonry was started much later, in 17th century Britain, not by stonemasons, but by middle-class gentlemen. The movement soon caught on.
It was a period of great religious and political turmoil when differences of opinion on religion and politics not only split families but led to the civil war in this country and to bloodshed and brother fighting brother. And we believe that the people who started Freemasonry were a group of people who wanted to have some sort of forum where they could meet without the differences of religion and politics coming into it.
The dangers you have escaped are those of stabbing and strangling. For on your entrance to the lodge, this poniard was presented to your naked left breast to imply that had you rashly attempted to rush forward, you would have been accessory to your own death by stabbing. While the brother who...
The blood-curdling rituals of Freemasonry today were invented in the early 18th century. At that time of religious and political persecution, a fearsome oath of secrecy may have seemed essential. But can the same be true today?
Equally fatal. But the danger, which traditionally would have awaited you until your latest hour, was the physical penalty, a one-time associated with the obligation of a Mason, that of having your throat cut across had you improperly disclosed the secrets of Masonry.
According to their own video, today's Masons steadfastly keep the secrets of the rituals for innocent, if masochistic, reasons.
You would lose all the mystique, I think, if you knew what was going through. The fear, for example. If I knew what was going to happen, I don't think I'd have got the same pleasure.
Earlier this century, hundreds of Protestant clergy were Masons. The craft was an unquestioned pillar of society, and bishops, even archbishops, felt its rituals supported religion. But growing unease provoked a Church of England inquiry, which reported in 1986 that elements of Freemasonry are incompatible with Christianity, even blasphemous. Today, many Anglican priests share the Catholic view that Masonry's offer of spiritual light is not just unacceptable, they think it's a satanic fraud.
Well-meaning people, good, honest, upright people, are being deceived. And the Bible teaches us that there's one source of the deceiver who is described as the devil, Satan. And I think underneath it all, it is a deception. It purports to be light, but is in fact darkness.
Freemasonry stresses it is not a religion, only that its members must be male, over 21, and believe in a god, any god. Freemasons of different faiths pray together to a supreme being, who is referred to as the great architect of the universe. We asked Jane Furbank, as a psychologist and a woman, for her thoughts on the great architect.
Well, this is obviously a biased point of view, but he sounds to me rather a masculine sort of god. There seems to be very little talk about the more spiritual side, or what you might describe as the more feminine side of religion. There's no Freemason equivalent of the Virgin Mary, for example. This god requires you to stand up straight, to make certain very precise gestures, you know, to talk a great deal about being straight and level and square. Not round, you notice, but square. If you look at the psychology of symbols, you'll find roundness is the mind, the spirit, its wholeness, and squareness is much more order, material, physical world.
So why do men continue to join Freemasonry in the face of suspicion, even outright condemnation? It's difficult for outsiders not to think that self-interest and career considerations must play a part. Certainly the view persists that the code of mutual aid in the ritual can lead to brother Masons combining to the detriment of non-Masons. Those Masonic bonds of preferment seem to apply in unlikely places. Ex-Detective Sergeant John Simons was a Freemason when he was in the Metropolitan Police. Later he went to prison, convicted of soliciting a bribe.
Freemasonry is rife in prison. I must say I spent some time in an open prison where I witnessed, contacts between Masonic prisoners and Masonic prison warders, and Masonic prisoners were getting special visits and having parcels left by the gate and all this sort of business.
But Masonic prisoners may enjoy more than special privileges. Informal lodge meetings are held in Britain's jails, as one bemused inmate discovered.
I go to the meeting, and there is the chaplain and a deputy vicar from outside, two or three prison officers, and maybe half a dozen prisoners.
T. Dan Smith, one-time boss of Newcastle City Council, had been sentenced to 6 years jail in 1976 for corruption. He was not a Freemason.
I just didn't know what the hell I'd put myself into. And within minutes, obviously they knew that I didn't know what I was doing there and that I wasn't a Mason. And consequently, there were considerable annoyance. The chaplain of all people said, oh, you know, this is outrageous. What, you know, why didn't it? And of course, I was out in 2 seconds flat. But by then, of course, I knew what the score was.
Contrary to many Masons' belief, nothing in their vows forbids them telling outsiders that they are Masons. Yet as long as most refuse to admit membership, they will encounter suspicion that they use Masonry to combine clandestinely and to scratch each other's backs.
I don't mind mutual sustenance, and certainly I positively like charitable organisations which provide a service, and many of the lodges, much of Freemasonry does that and concentrates on that. It's when it becomes something more than that, not only a means of serving the community, but of serving themselves, that it becomes worrying.
This concern about the Brotherhood has recently been reflected nationwide. In the last 5 years, in response to local allegations of Masonic skullduggery, councils from Liverpool and Manchester to Worthing and Southend have expressed grave misgivings about Freemasonry. Questions have been asked in Parliament, and police committees up and down the country have debated Masonic influence within the police force.
Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody to this meeting of the Islington Police Community Consultative Group.
During the next 5 weeks, this series will investigate public concern about the Brotherhood. Freemasons claim to occupy higher moral ground than non-Masonic outsiders, but a constant flow of allegations suggests that Freemasonry may be a perfect vehicle for corruption. Corruption in law enforcement, in local government, and in business. Overseas, it has even been used to subvert democracy. Next week, we investigate the unacceptable convergence of Freemasonry and corruption in Britain's police forces.
Our master, true to his obligation, answered that those secrets were known to but three in the world, and that without the consent and cooperation of the other two, he neither could nor would divulge them.
But this is Freemasonry's third degree ceremony, when the candidate becomes a Master Mason. It reenacts the murder of Hiram Abiff, the mythical architect of Solomon's Temple. 500,000 men in Britain today, including some 22,000 police, have been through this ritual climax.
The ruffian aimed a violent blow at the head of our master, but being startled by the firmness of his demeanor, it missed his forehead and only glanced on his right temple, but with such force that it caused him to reel and sink down on his left knee. Recovering from the shock,
the mystique and the power of a ritual like this can certainly sway some people who would perhaps rather not think for themselves, or who would do anything rather than give up that feeling of support and backing and strength that they get from the group. And those are the people who will say, I was following orders. You know, I couldn't betray my mates, even though whatever it was patently wrong.
Nowhere is the pressure to stand by your mates stronger than in the police, where generations of detectives have used Freemasonry as a cover for corruption. Tonight, we reveal the hidden Masonic connections in some of Britain's biggest police corruption scandals, and the Scotland Yard network, which one Masonic detective branded a firm in a firm. In 1987, Detective Alan Holmes, a Freemason who had joined the craft while serving at Croydon Police Station, faced the ultimate test of his Masonic loyalty. Holmes was not corrupt, but was under great pressure to betray a Masonic colleague. Scotland Yard's anti-corruption squad, CIB2, believed he knew of crooked links between a Masonic detective commander and Freemason Kenneth Noy, convicted of receiving part of the £26 million worth of gold stolen in Britain's biggest ever robbery, the 1983 Brinksmat job. Unknown to Holmes, CIB2 arranged for him to be secretly recorded as he gossiped to a fellow detective in his lodge. When Holmes was told he had unknowingly shopped his brother Masons, he became deeply distressed. One morning, in his back garden, he shot and killed himself. Former Detective Sergeant John Simons worked with Holmes in the 1960s.
I knew Teffy Holmes very well. He was my right-hand man, really, for some time. Whenever I was on night duty CID, I always took Taffy along with me as my assistant and companion. He was a strong man. Very good man, strong, honest, no fear in him whatsoever.
At the time of his death, Taffy Holmes was the master of Manor of Bensham Lodge, which had at least five serving or retired policemen among its members. The conflict between Holmes's loyalty to Masonry and the police was too much for him. His fellow Masons from Croydon Masonic Hall sent symbolic wreaths to his funeral. One was inscribed,
"To our brave, wonderful and worshipful master, who chose death rather than dishonour his friends and workmates."
Some of his lodge brothers clearly thought that Taffy Holmes, like Hiram Abiff, had died rather than betray Masonic secrets.
Our master remained firm and unshaken when the villain, who was armed with a heavy maul, struck him a violent blow on the forehead, which laid him lifeless at his feet.
Freemasonry and police corruption have been bedfellows for decades. Many allegations involve outsiders using Masonic bonds to persuade policemen to drop prosecutions for offences like careless driving. Former Inspector Brian Hilliard, now the editor of Police Review, is a non-Mason. He recalls an incident from his own career.
A sergeant said to me, "I was in a certain place last night, and Mr. Brown, who I believe you're going to prosecute me, approached me and wondered if you have to go forward with the prosecution." I said, "Well, you know, it will depend entirely on what the witnesses say." He was prosecuted. He saw me before court, and he says, "Does this have to happen?" I said, "It depends on witnesses." He was fined, and as he came out of court, he shook his head very sadly. He said, "I don't know how we can do this to one another." Now, I know absolutely that he was a Mason and thought I was a Mason.
Many police who are not in the Brotherhood are concerned about its influence. But Masonic policemen see no conflict between the job and the craft.
Every police officer, the day he walks into whichever training establishment, takes an oath to her sovereign lady, the Queen, to serve her in the office of constable without fear or favour. And that is paramount. Whatever else you do in your life, whatever else you become, whether you're a Boy Scout, a Freemason, or you join the local golf club, it matters not. It is your obligation as a constable that is paramount.
One of the dangers and one of the wrong things about Freemasonry within the police force is that you have here a group of people who have loyalties which are stronger more important to them than their loyalties to the police force and to the public as their oath.
But why do so many young policemen become Freemasons?
There's certainly a feeling that if you are a Mason, you better your chances of promotion, or you better your chances of being selected for in London for the CID.
This was exactly the experience of John Simons. Having become a Mason in the army, he joined the Metropolitan Police in 1960. When he wanted to join the elite CID, he found his Masonry came in very handy. But there was another vital qualification for young police anxious to become detectives.
You either had to be corrupt or you had to condone corruption. You were tested in a way, you know. They didn't want to bring into the CID people who were going to be horrified by corruption and were going to make waves and complain about it and whatnot. And you were really tested. You would not only corruption in as much as that you would be prepared to accept money, or perhaps if you weren't prepared to accept money, you wouldn't make a fuss about other people. You would condone it.
When Simons joined CID, a dangerous tradition prevailed at Scotland Yard. To keep the lid on serious crime, some senior officers took payoffs from major criminals and let them run the rackets.
They gave them licenses. They used them as a sort of police force, in a way, to patrol and control the areas that they operated in. Now, that relationship was itself corrupt, but it was also oiled by money, which gave it another degree of corruption. It was a pretty nasty pot.
In 1969, the Times newspaper was contacted by a small-time criminal claiming to be fed up with detectives extorting money from him. Reporters tape-recorded his next encounters with detectives, one of whom explained how the criminal could buy immunity to commit crime all over London.
And the phrase that he used, that the officer used, was, "I'm a member of a little firm within a firm." The implications of that, that there was a secret society, a tight-knit group of police officers who dealt amongst themselves and who could guarantee immunity for criminals around the whole of the metropolitan area. That phrase gave a depth and a ring to what was to become a major corruption scandal.
The officer who talked of the firm in a firm was Freemason John Simons. When the story was published, he was charged with soliciting a £50 bribe and suspended. While not denying his part in the corruption of the time, he claims the actual charge was absurd. Faced with what he saw as a fit-up, he sent word to the officers probing the allegations that if jailed, he would expose many other corrupt detectives. The chief investigator was a Freemason, Superintendent Bill Moody, then head of London's Obscene Publications Squad.
I sent a message to Moody through another Freemason saying that I wouldn't stand for the fit-up. I knew what was going on. And unless he stopped doing what he was doing, I intended to expose everything that I knew about Metropolitan Police, corruption, Freemasonry, its involvement in corruption, himself and pawn squad, which I knew about.
In threatening to expose his brother Masons, Simons was only too aware of the traditional punishment awaiting Masonic traitors, being cut in half.
A penal sign is given by drawing the hand smartly across the body.
The threat is perhaps symbolic, but according to Simons, the reality is just as bad.
This is an illusion. It's much more dangerous to receive a Masonic threat. It's not the sort of what the injuries to be inflicted. It means that a group of people who have power have this tremendous animosity towards you, a group animosity, if you like,
And the threat is that certain bad things will befall you.
The full penalty was that of having been severed in two, the bowels burnt to ashes, and the ashes scattered over...
Simons resolved to fight fire with fire. He gave a solicitor a dossier listing the crimes of fellow detectives to be published if anything happened to him. Some colleagues then offered Simons a deal, which he now discloses for the first time.
I was more or less escorted out of the country. I received advice and money from my colleagues.
What kind of money? How much money?
Well, I received £2,000, which in those days was an awful lot of money.
Where did this money come from?
It came from Superintendent Moody originally, but I'm not saying he supplied it all, but it was, you know, and various other colleagues of his.
Simons fled abroad. When he returned 7 years later, he received a 2-year jail term. Ironically, by then, the very man who'd been investigating him was himself doing 12 years. Bill Moody had been jailed in 1977, along with Commander Ken Drury of the Flying Squad. These two Masons had both been taking colossal bribes from pornographers.
Now, nobody seriously who looked at that case would other than accept that Moody took probably £40,000 a year in corrupt payments. So you're talking about a lot of money. Now, Moody was a Mason. He was a Mason in his lodge in Surrey. And we know from the Pawn Squad trials that he had dealings with at least one pornographer, a man called Ron the Dustman Davy, so-called because he was at one stage a dustman, though he was better known to Moody as a pornographer. They met at Moody's lodge, and they had subsequent dealings through Freemasonry lodges. Now, Moody and Davy were involved in a corrupt relationship together, and Davy was used as an agent by Moody to establish other corrupt relations. We know from the trial that Moody entertained pornographers at Masonic functions. And we also know that at least three of the people who were tried with Moody were Masons.
The Pawn Squad trials lifted the veil on a hidden world in which Masonic police were mixing with Masonic crooks in the secrecy of Masonic lodges. But honest Masons argue it is to the Brotherhood's credit that several witnesses for the Crown were also on the square.
Some of the people who brought them to justice were in fact Freemasons, but primarily they were good investigative police officers, and they did not depart from the true course of their duty. They pursued it with a rigour which it certainly deserved and which is fully merited.
Back in 1877, exactly 100 years before the Pawn Squad trials, bribery and corruption had become so endemic in Scotland Yard's detective department that complete reorganisation was necessary. Even then, Masonry had played a dominant role. So although there are many honest Masonic policemen, Freemasonry and police corruption have always been hand in glove.
For a young officer to join the Masons, there've got to be some question marks. I mean, why do men of 25, 26 want to join a fairly old-fashioned organisation which has a fuddy-duddy image, a fairly serious image? They must see something in it for themselves.
Yet there is a more charitable explanation for why policemen join Freemasonry, one which reflects the difficulties they face when seeking friendships outside the job.
Serving as a police officer, one is fairly restricted into the social contact that you have. You're constrained with the people that you meet outside of the police service who may be a dishonest character. And Freemasonry, as I saw it, was an opportunity for me to enjoy a social life outside the police service, whereby you met honest and true people, because that's really the claim of Freemasonry, to be just and upright, true members of society.
John Simmons had been a Mason for 15 years when in 1978 he moved from Scotland Yard to take charge of the CID in the City of London Police, the force which polices London's historic square mile. Corruption had been rife among city detectives for decades. In May 1978, a security guard was shot dead as he delivered £200,000 in wages to the Daily Mirror. It was the third violent robbery to hit the city in 18 months, netting the robbers £640,000. Each was carried out with an ease indicating the gangsters had been working with corrupt police. Simmons started his new job the day after the Mirror robbery. Already suspicious of some of the detectives now under his command, he decided not to reveal that he himself was a Mason.
I knew that the principals involved in it were Freemasons, and I didn't want to go in there with any chance of being caught up with them. I just wanted to avoid anybody knowing. I wanted to do my job as it should be done. And when officers first met me, all the usual signs, language and contact were made to try and identify whether I was a Freemason.
Simmons didn't respond to these Masonic approaches, but his ploy came unstuck when an ambitious and talented detective chief inspector named Phil Cuthbert met an old friend of Simmons at a Masonic function.
Cuthbert virtually came running into my office the next day and sort of said, "You've been telling porkies, Governor, you know." And I said, "Well, what's up, Phil?" And he said, "You're on the square." And then he mentioned the guy's name. And I either had to make him appear a liar. I said, "Okay, Phil, I am a Freemason, but that doesn't cut any ice. That makes no difference to me. As far as the job is concerned, that's outside the job." And he said, "Fine, you know, that's lovely." He shook my hand and so pleased to know and everything like that. And within minutes and during the next course of a few days, all the chaps that had tried to approach me, they all come in with sort of smirky smiles and sort of said, "Oh, you know, so pleased to know you're on the square." And I said to everybody, "It makes no difference. The job will be done as it should be done, and it has no bearing." And nobody said anything to the contrary, but it obviously wasn't taken on board of what I'd said.
Simmons' fellow Mason, Phil Cuthbert, now asked if he could have a quiet word on the square. Simmons guessed this meant Cuthbert wanted to confide his crooked role in the robberies on the Masonic understanding that nothing would be revealed to anyone else. But Simmons was not prepared to treat confidentially any criminal admission, so he went to his meeting with Cuthbert with a concealed tape recorder. They met in a pub in Artillery Passage, where Cuthbert talked for 3 hours about senior detectives and their collusion in the recent robberies. He was also recklessly frank about his own role.
I think Phil took Freemasonry in a very serious vein, and he believed that, as I was a now an accepted brother, that he could talk to me under those lines. And, you know, many Freemasons take the craft very, very seriously, like a religion, and that it's sacrosanct to them. And I think that he felt that he could talk to me under that vein and that I would not let him down.
Simmons' evidence formed the heart of the case against Cuthbert in his 1982 trial for taking up to £80,000 in bribes. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. But the man who gave evidence against him now became a Masonic outcast.
I went to a meeting in the Connaught Rooms, which after all I'm sure most people know is virtually the headquarters of British Freemasonry. And the chap who I'd known for many, many years was there as police officer and a Freemason, and we called eye across, I suppose, twice the distant time sitting from you, and he just stared at me and just shook his head like that, run his finger across his throat. I thought, gosh, what am I doing here? I need to get out of this place, because if one man can do that, I need to get out.
But what exactly did that gesture mean?
Well, it's part of if one breaches Freemasonry, then you take certain oaths, and one of them is that you'd rather have your throat cut than to divulge secrets of Freemasonry.
The sign is given by drawing the hand smartly across the throat and dropping it to the side. This is an allusion to the symbolic penalty at one time included in the degree, which implied that as a man of honour, a Mason would rather have his throat cut across than improperly disclose the secrets.
I don't think anybody very seriously believes that these threats will be carried out. But this doesn't detract from the psychological force of it. There's nothing like fear to instill loyalty. But I think even more powerful is the other fact that comes out in the ritual, where they say not only will these appalling things happen to you physically, but you will be cast out from us in every other way. In other words, if you betray the Freemasons, you're like the bloke who runs away in wartime, the chap who lets the regiment down, the one who lets the side down, who suddenly becomes the total outsider, the strikebreaker who's sent to Coventry for 20 years. In other words, they say, we're the most important thing in your life.
We never spoke. Words and actions, and it wasn't an idle gesture. It was one I took and in the way in which he meant it to be given.
John Simmons resigned from his lodge, dismayed at the gap between Freemasonry's high principles and their often shady practice.
You agree to be a good man and true, and strictly to obey the moral law. You are to be a peaceable subject, and cheerfully to conform to the laws of the country in which you reside.
As portrayed in the Freemason's own video, these moral principles are read out to every lodge master at his installation. But apparently too many Masons stray far from the Masonic ideal. Leonard John Gibson is a case in point. In 1979, Gibson was installed as Master of the Waterways Lodge, which meets at the Southgate Masonic Centre in North London. He had reached this rank just 7 years after his initiation. But Masonry was not Gibson's only interest. At that time, Scotland Yard's Flying Squad was circulating a confidential handbook of London's top 100 violent thieves, among them Worshipful Master Len Gibson. On one page was his mugshot, on the next his criminal record, including convictions for handling stolen goods and shop-breaking. Gibson's modus operandi, or crime speciality, was shown as armed robbery. Yet there were 8 policemen among the brethren of the Waterways Lodge at the time Gibson was master. One of them was former Flying Squad Chief Inspector John Brian McNeil, who declined to talk to us. Perhaps these policemen saw no conflict in being in the same lodge as a convicted criminal. If so, they were not alone in this view, as later events proved. Soon after becoming Worshipful Lodge Master, Gibson pulled off one of Britain's biggest ever robberies, the theft of silver bullion worth £4 million. 3 months later, he was arrested, and in January 1981, at the Old Bailey, he was given a 10-year jail term, as were 2 other Masons in the gang. So what happens to Masons convicted of serious crime?
They should be excluded from the institution completely. As far as being Freemasons is concerned, there should be no road back. That is my personal opinion. They should be excluded from the order and never be taken back.
Not all of Freemasonry feels that way, for the silver robbers weren't thrown out. Throughout Gibson's 5 years in jail, he was listed by the Waterways Lodge as a country member. On his release, the lodge welcomed him back. And even after newspapers revealed that the robbers were Freemasons, the Brotherhood's ruling body, Grand Lodge, decided they could stay in the craft. Then, 6 weeks ago, Grand Lodge changed course. At a 90-minute hearing, the robbers were allowed to plead their case in front of hundreds of Freemasonry's high and mighty. Most voted against the criminals, so they were expelled, but only after an intense and unprecedented debate. We asked Freemasonry's Grand Secretary what was the argument in favour of the robbers remaining in the Brotherhood.
Nothing that really held much water. They felt that they'd repaid their debt to society, which I think is probably not quite true, and it's one of those offences, if you look at the law, it's one which can never be spent. They joined their Freemasonry, they felt they got something to contribute to it. And Grand Lodge felt that they might have something to contribute, but their presence as convicted robbers was an embarrassment.
It took 9 years for Grand Lodge to discover that armed robbers performing Masonic rituals alongside police was an embarrassment to the Brotherhood.
In a society so widely extended as Freemasonry, the branches of which are extended over the four quarters of the globe, it cannot be denied we have many members of rank and opulence.
During his initiation, every apprentice Mason is told that Freemasonry is a moral organization, and its three guiding principles are brotherly love, relief, and truth.
In more modern terms, you could probably describe them as brotherly love, toleration, tolerating other people's ideas, getting on with people whether they hold the same ideas as you or not. Relief, charity in its widest sense, not just giving money, but giving of your time, your talents, your expertise within the community as a whole. And truth, striving to be as truthful as you can in your dealings with other people, in the way you carry out your daily life, and sort of acting squarely with people.
But these sentiments have a hollow ring for some disillusioned Masons.
Brotherly love, relief and truth has been replaced by envy, hypocrisy and lies.
It will be thankfully received and faithfully applied.
Have you anything to give in the cause of charity?
I have to give my talents to the masonry.
Were you deprived of everything valuable previously to entering the lodge?
Yes.
If you had not been so deprived, would you give freely?
Yes, I would.
Worshipful master.
A brother is asked for money, for charity. And they make sure he has none. And they say to him, you will remember that peculiar moment when you were first admitted into Freemasonry, figuratively poor and penniless. Now then, I know that that is done to impress the charitable work of Freemasons. But there's men at the top. Don't give money. When I was the charity rep, I had a right job to get from the top Freemasons' Grand Lodge officers £5 a year. I had to write to them sometimes three times.
My commander, your worshipful master, I give you the tiler's toast. To all poor and distressed Freemasons, we're ere dispersed over the face of earth and water.
Tonight, we examine three cases which call into question Masonry's claims of brotherly love and truth.
To all poor and distressed Freemasons.
And we look at Freemasonry's record on charity. Masonic charity is not like rattling collecting cans on street corners. Each member is expected to give what he can afford, and Freemasonry is like a big mutual assurance fund, with most of what Masons give to charity going to fellow Masons or their families who've fallen on hard times. They raise money for Masons' widows and children, for a Masonic school, and for charities serving the Masonic aged and sick. They have their own hospital, the Royal Masonic, in London. For these holy Masonic causes, the Brotherhood's charities in England and Wales collect and expend around £16 million each year. But recently, local newspapers have been deluged with hundreds of stories about Freemasons' gifts to non-Masonic charities. Apparently, the Masons are building a new image, as the Kent Evening Post reported in June 1987, when Masons handed a cheque to a Chatham hospital.
Masons have been told to build a new image and go public on some of their good works.
Increasingly today, Freemasonry gives from the money it raises to non-Masonic causes. This minibus was presented to help the aged by Masons in the...
Armed with their own public relations video, rank-and-file Masons now emphasise a new outward-looking image.
Freemasonry in this country and throughout the world has done a great deal towards the community. And no more can this be seen than in the question of the amount of money that Freemasonry gives to charities which have nothing whatsoever to do with Freemasonry. As you will know, they've given £250,000 to the Great Ormond Street Appeal.
But we've discovered that of every £20 collected and spent in 1988 by English Freemasonry's national charities, £19 went on Masons or their dependents, and just £1 to non-Masonic charities. Out of a total of £16 million, only £800,000 went to other causes. So despite their new image, the brethren, it seems, still prefer to look after their own. The Masons have been cleaning up their image for a more particular reason, to fight mounting opposition from Christians. In 1986, while a Church of England inquiry was trying to decide whether Freemasonry was incompatible with Christianity, the Brotherhood announced it was giving sums of £5,000 to Salisbury and three other cathedrals. Since then, many more cathedrals have each been given £5,000. Masons say this is to help save Britain's architectural heritage and to honour the stonemasons from whom they claim descent, but Anglican priest John Lawrence is not convinced.
It's a strange coincidence that, as Freemasonry has been seen in rather a bad light recently by the Church of England, that they're now giving more money to it. Now, is it to cull favour? Well, I suppose everybody has their own opinions on that. I would ask, why don't they give it secretly? Why do they make such a fanfare of publicity about it?
Great architect of the universe, may we who are blessed remember those in need.
Amen. The truth is that for all its talk of charity, Freemasonry is mainly a social club, and each lodge is a meeting place where men of substance eat, drink, and discuss common interests. At local and national level, they probably give an average of £10 a head to non-Masonic causes, but this pales into insignificance compared with the hundreds of pounds each Mason spends every year on Masonic wining, dining, and dressing up.
I think you can truthfully say that it's no use becoming a Freemason if you haven't got a bob or two. Because if you go to your Masonic lodge and you pay for your meal, and then you go to the installations and the ladies' evenings and all the other social functions, they're not cheap, you see. Not cheap at all.
Ain't seen the sunshine, I don't know when. Stuck in Folsom Prison, and get dragging on.
If helping worthy causes were a Mason's prime aim, he could do it just as well outside the lodge. For example, the charity country and western concerts which non-Mason John Watman and his friends put on in the early 1980s helped raise £250,000 for Stoke Mandeville Hospital. So it's poignant that this man of charity suspects he was forced into bankruptcy as a result of action by Freemasons in and around the small Oxfordshire town of Watlington. In 1982, Watman bought an old pub on the outskirts of the town. Called the Carrier's Arms, it was well known for live music. Watman started putting on different music each night, and the new venture thrived. But some local residents complained there was too much noise from the pub. The police were soon paying calls, sometimes three or four times a night.
I never found out anyone's name who had been complaining. In the end, I was just told they were anonymous calls. And really, looking back on it, the amount of time that must have been wasted on anonymous calls from Thames Valley Police was incredible, really. Just coming from Tame alone must have taken them 15 minutes, and if they're doing this three times a night some nights.
A pub's drinks licence must be renewed every year, but when Watman's came up for renewal, he found out that a hostile petition had been raised in the name of a ratepayers' association. He started a counter-petition, but two local traders told him they couldn't sign because they were in the same Masonic lodge as the man organising the petition against him, Robert Hilton. This connection was later confirmed by a confidential Masonic directory which lists Robert Hilton as a past master of Watlington's Icknield Way Lodge. It also names the two traders who refused to sign Watman's petition and three more of his neighbours. Mr. Hilton says he organised the petition on behalf of other residents, not for himself, and denies that Masons were ganging up on Watman.
Go, Johnny, go, go, go.
But Watman's drinks licence was renewed. So was his music licence, after council tests proved the music did not reach nuisance level. Even when live bands were playing, the meters proved the noisiest sound outside the pub was the squeaking of the pub sign. Yet Watman's problems got worse.
The pressure from the police was incredible. I mean, they were coming down one particular night. They came down, I think there was four times in an evening, and sat outside in the car park till everyone had gone. Now, if you run a public house, it's very difficult to run it successfully if police are there all the time. And it was then I began to think they're doing it for a reason, to stop customers coming.
Convinced that police pressure was ruining business, Watman decided to quit. He closed the pub and put it on the market. But before he could find a buyer, the drinks license had to be renewed again. This time the police objected, not because of the noise, but in effect because of the silence. They claimed the shut-down pub was a temptation to burglars. At the last minute, seven police officers came to the court to give evidence, but as Wattman's barrister had not been notified, they were not allowed to testify. Even so, the magistrates decided against him.
They were out for half an hour and they came back and decided that I didn't have a pub licence anymore.
Even though, in a sense, no evidence...
No evidence was given at all. No evidence was given against me as a person, whatever, you know.
The magistrate's decision brought financial disaster on John Wattman. He had to sell the carrier's arms for £30,000 less than he paid and was forced into bankruptcy. But now he felt he was assembling more and more pieces of a Masonic jigsaw. He had long been puzzled by the attitude of Inspector Ron Duncan, who had been in charge of the officers from Tame Police Station who had paid so many visits to the carriers. But Duncan was not only a police officer, as Wattman now learned from a friend who was a former policeman.
He himself was a Freemason, and he said to me, did I know that Inspector Duncan was also a Freemason from the St Mary's Lodge at Tame, where all the lodges meet in that area? And I said, no, I said, I knew nothing about the Masonic there. And then he pointed out all the people that were involved with what happened to me who were Freemasons.
Wattman made many complaints against Thames Valley Police, alleging harassment, but a 20-month inquiry found no evidence to justify taking any action against any officers. He's still convinced he was victimised, but the mere fact that most of the people he came up against were on the square proves not conspiracy, only coincidence. He's now back in his old job as an engineer. It's ironic that he's using Freemasonry's symbolic tools for a practical purpose, making walking aids for disabled children. Dissatisfied with the police investigation, Wattman has taken his complaint to English Freemasonry's headquarters.
We've looked at it, we find that there are two people who opposed the grant of a licence for his pub because they believed it was going to be noisy and disturb them, and those two people happened to be Freemasons. Nothing to do with the lodge at all.
Can you understand why, though, that he should see a Masonic conspiracy when he discovers that many of the people who he perceives to be against him, ratepayers, leaders, councillors, policemen, are all Freemasons who all meet at the same Freemasons' hall?
I can't understand it, because I know that Freemasonry isn't for that sort of thing.
Some people might think you're sort of paranoid, you're imagining the whole thing.
I think that's how they get away with it, that they like to interpret it that way. But I don't think I'm paranoid. I've stuck at it for 5 years now to try and prove in some way or another what can or what can be misused within the Masonic organisation.
Arthur Edmonds is a Freemason, but he also feels that his life has been ruined by the charitable brotherhood known as Freemasonry. He and his wife Joyce were running a travel firm called Cruise Drive Tours Limited in the 1970s, when friends suggested that they should organise cruises for Masons and their families.
Do you seriously declare that unbiased, by the improper solicitation of friends against your own inclination, and uninfluenced by mercenary or other unworthy motive, you freely and voluntarily offer yourself as a candidate for the privileges and mysteries of Freemasonry?
I do.
At his initiation, every Mason swears not to use Freemasonry for personal profit. As a past lodge master, Arthur Edmonds was well aware of this, but the whole point of the cruises was that all profits would go to Masonic charity. It's unusual for Masons to raise money like this, but with the help of a Masonic colleague, he got clearance from Grand Lodge and advertised in the national press. The first cruise was a huge success, and a second was needed to meet demand, but Edmonds was steaming into troubled waters.
I was summoned before the Grand Secretary. I thought, well, good, I'm going to be congratulated for raising, I think by then it was about £28,000 for charities.
But the Grand Secretary at the time, James Stubbs, did not offer congratulations. According to Arthur Edmonds, the meeting, which took place here at Freemasons Hall, was anything but pleasant. Referring to letters of complaint from a few Masons, the Grand Secretary said he was opposed to Masonic cruises in general and advertising them in particular.
I'm not having it, he said. No more. I said, no more. Masonry teaches me look after charities. And that's what I'm doing. Quite legally, and with your permission. I said, you are conducting a star chamber with me, and I won't have it. With that, I walked out of his room.
Grand Lodge then dropped a bombshell in the quarterly communication or newsletter which it sends to every English Mason. It stated,
the board wishes to make it clear that recent advertisements and circulars about so-called Masonic cruises do not have its approval or sanction. The board strongly deprecates the association of Freemasonry with commercial ventures and does not consider that any statement that profits from such ventures will be devoted to Masonic charity affects this situation.
For Arthur and Joyce Edmonds, this was catastrophic. They'd contracted to pay £250,000 for ships for further Masonic charity cruises. But after the newsletter was read out in all lodges, bookings dried up and cancellations poured in. Edmonds was not just under attack from Grand Lodge. The very charities which had taken the money from his cruises were now denying they'd ever got any.
All of a sudden, they'd be having cheques returned by the charities. They wouldn't accept them. One particular one, the Masonic Hospital, stated that they could not state whether any money had ever been received from Cruise Drive Tours Limited, or me. And yet before that I'd had masses of congratulatory letters and I had every receipt.
15 years earlier, Edmonds had been charged with deception and fraud in connection with another business. He says he was framed, but his barrister had strongly advised him to plead guilty and he was sentenced to 3 years in jail. The implication now that he had pocketed money destined for charity was like history repeating itself.
I myself called in Scotland Yard Fraud Squad and made them check all the books. I asked the Department of Trade and Industry to check all the books with all the bank statements and all the checks.
The Fraud Squad found nothing wrong, and for years Edmonds tried to clear his Masonic reputation and get a fair hearing from Grand Lodge. Eventually, the new Grand Secretary, Michael Higham, responded in a letter that he'd seen no evidence that any charity money raised by Edmonds had been misapplied. But this didn't solve Edmonds' problem.
I couldn't contact all the Masons in England. So I asked him to produce that letter or a statement in the Grand Lodge quarterly communication, which itself had ruined me. Refused.
Mr. Edmonds asked you to reproduce that letter in the quarterly communication to clear his name. Why did you refuse to do that?
Because I didn't reckon that I was in the business of clearing his name. What we had done was to stop his cruises being described as Masonic with apparently Grand Lodge's approval. He asked me for a different assurance and I went as far as I thought I reasonably could and I did so in that letter.
Edmonds had been ruined. As a result of Grand Lodge's actions, Cruise Drive Tours had gone bankrupt and he and his wife were reduced to living on the dole.
Surely they would not deliberately have destroyed your business and made you bankrupt.
I think for power, they would have done anything. And the power being that they could wield over ordinary Masons.
Not even its staunchest defenders would claim Freemasonry is democratic. But sometimes the hierarchy's preoccupation with rank and ceremonial can be offensive to ordinary brethren, such as when officers from Grand Lodge visit the more humble outposts of the craft.
These top brass come into a lodge, you have to give them salutation. And it annoys me immensely that you have to pay homage to the man. Some of them you give them 7 salutes, some 5, some 3. And then the man who is the most senior Mason will say, we thank you for your salutations. And you know damned well he's a hypocrite.
Freemason Leonard Acklam is a past master of the Brighouse Lodge in Brighouse, Yorkshire. Now running a china shop, he was previously a plumbing and heating engineer. Some years ago, he instructed a solicitor to take action to recover a debt of £10,000. For a whole year, whenever Acklam asked what was happening, the solicitor fobbed him off with excuses, until Acklam eventually heard from a court clerk that the case had been lost by default.
It had been dropped in the bin. I said, what do you mean? He says, you've lost by default. How can I have lost by default? Because your solicitor had an appointment at Huddersfield Crown Court with the defendant solicitor, and your solicitor never turned up. My God. £10,000 down the drain.
Like Acklam, the solicitor who failed to turn up in court was a Freemason. As such, he should have been bound by the ritual oath to support brother Masons.
I will not injure him myself.
I will not injure him myself.
Or knowingly suffer it to be done by others.
Or knowingly suffer it to be done by others.
If in my power to prevent...
Acklam was bound by the same oath, but felt that the solicitor's negligence should not go unpunished. He sought advice on whether or not to sue his brother Mason. That's when the pressure started.
Shortly after that, I was paid a visit in my place of business by a very high-ranking Freemason. Very high-ranking. And told that if I started any action against this particular solicitor, I would lose a lot of friends. I was told I had to look on it in a true Masonic manner and forget it. After all, you can afford it. Now then, it doesn't know whether I'm skint, whether I have two aprons to rub together or what.
The high-ranking Mason was Sir Herbert Redfern, Grand Officer of English Freemasonry and a former chairman of the National Union of Conservative and Unionist Associations.
Why on earth would he see fit to interfere in a private dispute?
To protect his own Masonic member. Nothing anymore. You see, I'm a nobody. I'm not a high-ranking Freemason. I'm the fellow with the pick and shovel that does the work. If you see what I mean. I mean, these are the fellows that go and sit on the top table and shout how wonderful Freemasonry is and then go back to the hypocrisy when they've taken their Masonic pinny off and the Masonic collar and the Masonic gloves.
Acklam was so outraged by Redfern's interference in a private dispute and the use of Masonic pressure that he protested to the Provincial Grand Lodge and then to Grand Lodge in London. An internal Masonic inquiry has just been set up, but Sir Herbert's now dead, and it's 8 years since Acklam first complained about attempted Masonic blackmail.
Why do you think Grand Lodge and the Yorkshire West Riding have done nothing about it?
Because of the rank of the man involved. I mean, he was closely associated with the Prime Minister, Cabinet Ministers. He's a very, very top man, was a top man. He's chairman of the magistrates. He's a very top man, not only a top Freemason, but a man with muscle, if you like.
Mr. Acklam, in a general sense, says that he believes that there is one law for those at the top of Freemasonry and that the rank and file are treated in a totally different way. How do you react to that charge?
I don't think that I can agree with it. At least in theory, the thing happens the same for everybody. And we are still trying to find out what Mr. Acklam is, the truth of Mr. Acklam's complaints.
In practice, is everybody treated the same?
I'd like to think so.
Like John Wattman and Arthur Edmonds, Leonard Acklam is typical of hundreds of people, many of them staunch Masons, who believe, rightly or wrongly, that the Brotherhood has interfered with their business or destroyed their livelihood. Sometimes truth, relief and brotherly love seem a bit thin on the ground.
I believe that the ordinary members of Freemasonry, generally speaking, you'll always find the black sheep, are genuine and good. But the higher they get in the rank, the more they seem to change, to become little Hitlers. They're just little dictators who tell you what to do and will not listen to a single word. They don't even ask your defence. Till afterwards.
Brotherly love, relief, and truth. That is Freemasonry. And I'm afraid with too many men at the top who do not believe in brotherly love, relief, and truth. They believe in themselves. What is in it for me?
Worshipful Master, I present to you Mr. Martin, a candidate properly prepared to be made a Mason.
Brothers, many of the 500,000 men initiated into Freemasonry in Britain are involved in local government. But is there a conflict of interest between Freemasonry's secret oaths and the public service?
Do you seriously declare, on your honour, that unbiased by the improper solicitation of friends, against your own inclination, and uninfluenced by mercenary or other unworthy motive, you freely and voluntarily offer yourself as a candidate for the privileges and mysteries of Freemasonry?
I do.
I do.
The averred aims of Freemasonry are highly moral ones. The only problem arises in that they also insist that you should support the group, fellowship with other Masons. The message is you can't stand on your own. You need us. And you can quite see that the thought of being out in the world naked without that would be very frightening. And that some people might well let loyalties to other more abstract institutions go by the wayside.
By thy glorious majesty.
The English language is littered with Masonic phrases like being on the level, upright and true, and getting a square deal. Masonry's symbolic tools are supposed to be reminders of its moral code. But up and down the country, there have been allegations of Masonic corruption in local authorities, from Cardiff to Bradford, from the north of Scotland to the south of England. Southend on the Thames estuary is typical of many seaside resorts. It seems to be virtually controlled by Freemasons. The Masonic Hall houses 43 craft lodges, 23 Royal Arch chapters, and many other Masonic orders. This town of 50,000 adult males contains 3,000 Masons from every walk of life. But do Southend's other residents know anything about Freemasons?
It's like a lodge, isn't it? Where people go, you know, you want to get on a bit. You're a Freemason, aren't you? And you're Masonics.
Brother speaks for brother, don't they?
Yes. Secret society, yeah.
What do they do?
Not a lot. They shake hands.
They're so secret we don't know what they do.
Yeah, they do. They stick they've to got a
special,
another, don't they?
Yes, they've got a special handshake. They wear silly leather pinnies and they're a secret society.
How powerful do you think they are in Southend?
Probably fairly powerful, I should imagine. There's a lot of very wealthy people about here that are very interested in doing that sort of thing.
Bunch of bastards. So man. The firm I work for is mainly run by Masons. Unfortunately, that led to a lot of people who aren't particularly good at their job getting into influential places.
Well, they're all over the place down here, everywhere you go.
Do you know who the Freemasons are?
Yes.
Yes, so we do. What sort of firm do you work in?
I wouldn't like to say, especially on camera. But you know who you are, don't you?
One of Southend's most eminent Masons is William Muckley, an ardent member of Crowstone Lodge, number 3298. For most of his working life, he was employed by Southend Council, and for 10 years he controlled all the town's council house allocations. But in 1979, Mr. Muckley moved in with his mistress in a council house she had just been allocated by his very own department. Muckley thereby attracted the attention of Paul Foote of the Daily Mirror.
That's how it started. I think we then found a number of other cases, in fact. One of the nastiest cases that occurred there, which wasn't to do with Muckley himself, but with one of his junior officials, was clear evidence that one of the junior housing officers there was housing divorced and divorced women and single parents in exchange for sexual favours. A thing which you can't imagine anything really more disgusting at that level. You can't imagine anything more revolting than that. And that, well, we exposed that as well. And I think all these things had roots in Masonry, Freemasonry.
Foote's revelations caused outrage in Southend. One Conservative councillor, Chris Hudson, was inundated with letters from angry constituents. He's not a Mason. He was concerned about the newspaper's allegations and called for an independent inquiry into the conduct of Mr. Muckley and the housing department. But Southend's Masons closed ranks.
It is an established fact from Masonic records that members within the housing department, officers, were Masons. That's just a question of historical fact. and it is a fact that several of my colleagues, former colleagues on the council, were Masons. And they stuck together like glue.
Only days after the revelations in the Daily Mirror, Brother Muckley was installed as worshipful master of Crowstone Lodge. He was also promoted to chief housing officer by Southend Council and given a large salary increase. At the same time, Councillor Hudson's pleas for an independent inquiry into Masonic abuse were turned down by the same council, and he was suspended by his Conservative colleagues from every committee on which he sat.
Their behaviour, their conduct in this town, as regards me and my position as a councillor, was appalling. I was shocked and appalled. I was very concerned at the press this town was getting. I did everything I could to have an inquiry. And yet, certain members within the Freemasonry wanted to keep the lid on things, keep the can of worms quiet, if you like, down in Southend.
Hudson took his suspension to the High Court. He claimed that democracy was being bypassed in Southend, partly as a result of the cosy, back-scratching relationships enjoyed in the town's Masonic lodges. The High Court upheld his complaint and instructed that Councillor Hudson be reinstated. Worshipful Brother Muckley was made redundant from his post as Chief Housing Officer in 1985. Southend said they had too many chief officers and he was nearing retirement. Since then, he's worked at a garage, but has just been given a job as a physical and recreational instructor at a local coeducational high school. Muckley's lodge meets at Southend's Masonic Temple, as do many other lodges. For these brethren, Freemasonry may be harmless socializing, but not to some outsiders.
Because they mingle in secret and because they tie one another up in this secret bond to one another, the tendency among all these people that are in this secret society is to defend one another rather than to expose one another to public accountability.
Accountability is very important in local government because councils spend huge amounts of ratepayers' money. Newham Council in the East End of London has an annual budget bigger than many third world countries. In 1980, a full roll of 75 members of the Borough of Newham Lodge leaked out. Non-Masons were horrified to discover the extent of Freemasonry's influence in the Labour-controlled borough.
It actually permeated the whole social fabric of the borough. The membership of the lodge indicated that there were members of the council, senior members of the council in membership. There were the officers, the senior officers and lower officers. There were contractors. There were even police connections.
Newham is just one of many councils with town hall lodges attached, where elected councillors, council officials and outside contractors meet in Masonic secrecy. But it isn't only the obvious town hall lodges which raise anxieties. In Rochford, Essex, a Conservative stronghold, Masonic influence has been the subject of stormy debate. Councillor Richard Boyd, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, contends that Freemasonry in Rochford is the Tory party in disguise, and that Tory councillors meet council officers in the same Masonic lodge.
There is a standing tradition in local government that paid officials do not attend caucus meetings of political parties. The reason is to prevent undue influence by one party on officials, or the ability of one party to obtain information, privy information, which is not made available to others. Now, if that rule is followed, it becomes illogical if you then all nip down to the Masonic lodge that evening and the members are from one party and paid officials. It destroys that attempt to separate political life from private life.
Boyd became concerned about Masonic influence in 1982 when the old council chamber was sold to local Masons without being put on the open market. It's now a Masonic temple. At least four Conservative councillors who were on the committee which authorised the sale were also Freemasons, but saw no need to declare an interest. We asked all these men about their conduct. None would respond, but a Mason who's become a councillor since the decision argues that Masonic councillors are under no obligation to declare themselves.
First of all, I think it is an impertinence to ask me as an individual what I do with my free time and my free money if I'm partaking in something which is not illegal or immoral, and Freemasonry is neither of these things. The next thing that we shall be asked to define is how much money we give to various charities, whether we drink South African sherry, etc. Where is the line drawn?
If there's a planning application concerning my wife, I declare an interest. If there's a planning application to turn the redundant council chamber of Rochford into a Masonic meeting place, which they buy, I would expect members of the Masonic movement to declare an interest. Well, they didn't.
Despite many Freemasons' protests, the issue of concealed membership is very often at the root of public mistrust of the Brotherhood, especially so in job promotions, when a Masonic candidate is found to have been chosen by other Freemasons. The 1981 appointment of Alf Parrish as Chief Constable of Derbyshire was a case in point.
Really quite bizarre. Mr. Parrish was appointed Chief Constable in a rather strange way. Many of us thought with undue haste at the time. Sadly, the Chief Constable at the time had tragically died of a heart attack. It was in April of 1981, and we were conscious that in May of 1981 there was likely to be a change of control of the County Council.
The new Chief Constable was hastily appointed by a subcommittee dominated by the ruling Tory group, which looked likely to lose the forthcoming elections. Parrish had been the serving deputy chief. It could be argued he was likely to have got the top job anyway, but his was not the only rushed promotion.
That was followed by an even more startling appointment of Mr. Parrish's deputy, Mr. Parkinson, who was appointed literally hours before the election, just one day, without proper adverts to satisfy the Home Office, and in spite of some considerable criticism from the Home Office, again it appeared that there was undue influence in both of those appointments.
With the new Chief Constable and his deputy now firmly ensconced at police headquarters, Labour gained its predicted victory and David Bookbinder became council leader. But not until 3 years later, when Bookbinder was sent a photocopy of the Derbyshire Masonic Yearbook, did he feel the mystery of Parrish's selection was explained. Prominent in the list of Derby Masons was the name of Alf S. Parrish, but there were also the members of the subcommittee which selected him. The Tory chairman, Angus MacDonald Miller, turned out to be a grand provincial officer of the craft. Also on the committee were the Masonic Tory councillors Royden Green and Walter Marshall, formerly the Conservative leader of the County Council. Even the Home Office inspector attached to the committee, James Page, was a Mason in London. But by this time, Brother Alf Parrish's tenure as Derby's Chief Constable was coming to a spectacular climax.
The committee that the thing will be all the way. What's your reaction to...
Parrish was retired in 1985 amid a scandal relating to over £30,000 expenses. But the Derbyshire Masonic Yearbook explained many other mysteries of county politics. For example, the membership list for the Tyrian Lodge, number 253, the county's oldest, which meets here at the Masonic Hall in Derby, included two former Conservative County Council leaders, three successive county clerks, who had run the council for more than 20 years, the High Sheriff, and the former Chief Constable, Sir Walter Stansfield. Clearly, some Tyrian Lodge members had dominated county affairs throughout the 1960s and 70s. Other names loomed out from other lodges, yet more Conservative councillors, the Lord Lieutenant and the Duke of Devonshire. These confidential Masonic papers disclosed a business, political, police and social directory of the entire county. They revealed Freemasonry's extraordinary power in Derbyshire and its effective role as the county's secret government.
You could say that it was the informal controlling body of Derbyshire County Council. It certainly successfully had its members appointed in their most sensitive and key positions that exist in this authority. It could all be a coincidence, but it really would be a very remarkable one.
The Tyrian Lodge of Derby does seem to contain a substantial slice of Derbyshire's ruling elite.
I hear what you say. But I could also tell you that Freemasons are taught from the very beginning of their Masonic activity that they're not to use Freemasonry to advance any sort of interest. The lodge may contain some important people, but that's an accident. They're not there to influence any sort of exercise any sort of influence at all.
It was no accident that certain Freemasons exercised a corrupt influence over many English local councils in the 1960s. That's when the Pontefract architect John Poulsen scooped up contract after contract by bribing local and national politicians. But when he was jailed for corruption in 1974, his Masonic connections were scarcely known, and he's written to us denying that Freemasonry ever helped him in business.
I was an enthusiastic, loyal member of my lodge for many years. I found Masonry fascinating, and I gave myself enthusiastically to its service. I can only say I did not use Masonry to further my business interest.
Poulsen's right-hand man and public relations fixer during the 1960s was the flamboyant T. Dan Smith, one-time boss of Newcastle City Council and dubbed by the press Mr. Newcastle. A non-Mason himself, Smith contradicts his one-time paymaster by claiming that Poulsen became a Mason in order to make contact with influential Labour politicians.
He said to me, I'm not a Mason, but I'm going to become a Mason, because he said Joe Blackburn, who is the mayor of Pontefract, I think was the mayor of Pontefract, and also the leader of the Pontefract Council, has convinced me that there are so many Labour Party local authority people Masons that I must have some means of contact because I'm known to be a Tory. And I believe that I'm right to be a Tory, and I'm not going to compromise on politics.
For some Yorkshire citizens, the legacy of the Poulsen affair is a deep distrust of Freemasons in politics. In 1986, three Bradford researchers uncovered long-buried evidence of Masonic opportunism over council plans to build a bypass through the Leeds suburb of Headingley.
I think what we've always been interested in, and I think most ordinary people are interested in, is what are the backroom deals? What is the wheeling and dealing?
In the 1960s, Masonic wheeling and dealing involved a five-acre plot of land, which was worth very little because it was inaccessible by road. But then Leeds Council earmarked half the land for a new bypass. The proposed road would give direct access to the rest of the plot, which would then rocket in value as prime building land. 20 years later, in the unlikely setting of a suburban bedroom, the three researchers began a painstaking investigation of company and council records, as well as confidential Masonic documents. They discovered that in 1966, 12 local Masonic lodges had banded together to form the Shire Oak Property Company in order to buy the 5 acres of land in Headingley.
That's a London one. So how were they divided up between local individuals and...
I think they seem to got rid of most of the shares to the actual lodges themselves in trust.
Many of the all-Masonic shareholders in the Shire Oak Company were Leeds councillors, and so in a good position to know the council's plans for the bypass. They included Alderman John Astle, JP, on the Transport Committee, Councillor Donald Bradley, Finance and Planning Committee, Lord Mayor and Alderman Alan Bretherick, Councillor Harold Jowett, Finance and Planning Committee, and Erwin Bellow, council leader from 1975 to 1979, when Mrs. Thatcher made him Lord Belwin and Minister for Local Government. In 1974, Leeds Council set up a voluntary register of councillors' interests.
Not one of these councillors had ever declared their interest in this matter, and really that's what the registers of interest were set up to protect against. People with inside information and inside influence on decisions actually profiting from decisions made at the council.
But as the three researchers found out, the Shire Oak Masons were to come unstuck. In 1976, Britain's Labour government announced huge cutbacks on road building. The local bypass was shelved, the value of the land slumped, and the Masons eventually had to sell out without making a profit. Even so, it is a matter of public concern that so many councillors had shares in a company which would benefit from their own council's decisions. Yet when the Shire Oak deal was exposed in 1986, the leaders of what was by then a Labour-controlled council did nothing to investigate their Tory forerunners.
It just seems like it's become par for the course, really, and I don't think it should. I think we ought to get to the point where we're shocked by things like this, and we're really not that shocked anymore.
The public may no longer be shocked by shadowy deals done in our local town halls, but we still like to think our national civil servants are incorruptible. Yet Freemasonry, which claims to demand high standards, is sometimes the breeding ground for corruption on a grand scale in the civil service. The Property Services Agency has an annual budget of £1 billion and employs 26,000 civil servants. It manages and maintains more than 8,000 public buildings, including the Tower of London and Hampton Court Palace. Recently, corrupt deals involving the PSA were hatched and executed under the cover of the Queenswood Lodge, which now meets here at London's Freemasons Hall. By the early 1980s, it was a honeypot for building contractors and corrupt civil servants. A key figure in the scandal was a contractor called Terry King. In 1981, King and a PSA officer, Eric Wenborn, were guests at a Queenswood Lodge ladies' night. Within a few months, both the builder and the civil servant were initiated as apprentice masons.
Having been kept for a considerable time in a state of darkness, what in your present situation is the predominant wish in your heart?
Light. Light.
Brother Junior Deacon, let that blessing be restored to the candidate.
While in a state of darkness, Wenborn had worked incorruptibly as a civil servant for 35 years. But within a year of becoming a mason, he was flying off to Las Vegas, all expenses paid, courtesy of his crooked builder brothers in the Queenswood Lodge. In June 1988, at the Old Bailey, Wenborn pleaded guilty to 5 charges of corruption and conspiracy to obtain bribes. The jury heard how, throughout 1983, his Masonic brothers had paid £1,000 a month into a Jersey bank account in his wife's name, about another free holiday in Miami, how he bought his mistress a £33,000 flat with his bribes, as well as spending money on his own home and buying himself a new car. Brother Eric Wenborn was eventually jailed for 2 years, a sad end to a civil service career that had spanned 4 decades.
What inquiries have been made by Grand Lodge following the recent court revelations of the involvement of a Masonic lodge in a network of bribery and corruption in the Property Services Agency?
Freemasons who were convicted by the court have been dealt with and expelled, and we've inquired into the affairs of one lodge which seemed to be concerned, and we find that there was nothing Masonically improper about it, and we are now inquiring into the affairs of another one. But we expect that we'll find, as we did in the first lodge, that there was nothing in the lodge which encouraged these people or allowed them to break the law.
Was this the Queenswood Lodge?
I can't remember which one of the two it is we sorted out.
In the Queenswood Lodge there were 2 contractors, 1 PSA official and 1 GLC official, mm-hmm. and all were convicted of bribery and corruption.
Yes. That doesn't mean to say that the lodge caused them or allowed them or helped them to be conspirators. It's just an accident of life that these people happen to be in the same lodge. There might be a lot of other organisations that they belong to the same. It might be nice to think they all go to the same church.
However nice it might be, these corrupt men did not all go to the same church. They did all go to the same lodge. But does it really matter if some Freemasons in public service have failed to meet the high standards of morality which the Brotherhood proclaims? Should the public care about petty Masonic abuse of power, such as afflicted Southend's housing department?
The scandal itself may well seem petty, but underneath that petty scandal is a basic principle, and it's the principle that democracy can be strangled. And if it can be happening here in petty Southend, as we say, then what could be happening in other corridors of power on a more senior level? What happens in Southend could well be happening in Parliament. We need more open government to get at the truth. We represent the people, we are here in the name of the people, and we cannot have secret societies operating within a framework of democracy. It's a paradox, it's a nonsense.
was likewise this cable tow with a running noose about your neck, which would have rendered any attempt at retreat equally fatal.
The cable tow, or noosed rope, is central to Masonic ritual, as is violent death.
Having your throat cut across, your tongue torn out by the root and buried in the sand of the sea at low watermark, or a cable's length from the shore where the tide regularly ebbs and flows twice in 24 hours.
On the 18th of June 1982, an Italian Freemason named Roberto Calvi was found hanged under London's Blackfriars Bridge. His body was suspended from scaffolding at a level where the tide ebbs and flows twice every 24 hours, in line with the Masonic ritual. The City of London police, who investigated his death, believed that Calvi had committed suicide, but his family say he was murdered.
There was no neck damage that was found, and there was no sign of dirt or rust on the ends. Now, the only way that a death could have occurred without causing neck damage was by holding on to some of the bars with the ends, which of course is impossible without leaving traces of rust or dirt.
He didn't think about to kill himself, to commit suicide, because he loved the life, he loved us, he wanted to stay with us.
Earlier this year, an Italian court decided that Calvi had indeed been murdered. One of Italy's most successful bankers, he had handled the secret finances of a powerful Masonic lodge. So was his death a ritual murder? Was he killed for threatening to reveal what Italian Masons had done with a missing £200 million? Or did he know too much about a Masonic plot to undermine Italian democracy? Calvi was boss of Italy's largest private bank, and so close to the Vatican and the Pope that he was known in Rome as God's banker. How he died 1,000 miles away in London is a bizarre mystery. Journalist Paul Foote investigated his death.
I never had any doubt about it at all. It seemed to me perfectly plain that it was a ritual murder carried out in the Masonic tradition.
Foote believes even the name of the bridge where Calvi died may have been significant. The image of a black friar is especially emotive for Italian Masons. The man who is in effect their patron saint, Giordano Bruno, was a 17th century monk burnt to death for his beliefs by the Papal Inquisition. The scaffolding from which Calvi was found hanged had been erected next to a ladder, which for Masons symbolizes death. In addition to the noose or cable tow around Calvi's neck, and the fact that his body was hanging where it was ritually covered by the ebb and flow of the tide, 12 pounds of bricks were found in his pockets. Stonework plays a central role in all Masonic ritual. A rough, uncut stone symbolizes the uncultured man before he joins Freemasonry, and a smooth stone indicates the fit member of a civilized society, which a Mason becomes after years learning the craft. Rough stones or bricks, as found in Calvi's pockets, symbolize failed or treacherous Masons.
It seemed to me that this was a Masonic ritual murder. And the astonishing thing about the whole affair was the casual way in which it was investigated by the City of London police, the casual way in which the suicide verdict was effectively accepted by the establishment, and that no one to this day has any real idea of how Calvi was murdered. On our soil, in the middle of our city, this thing happened, and we've no idea how it happened.
The job of investigating Calvi's death fell to the City of London Police, a small force with just 80 detectives. At the London inquest, city officers gave evidence suggesting Calvi had killed himself. His bank, the Ambrosiano, was in deep financial trouble, with £1,000 million of debts, and Calvi was facing 4 years in jail over a conviction for illegally exporting Italian currency. At the inquest, the coroner warned the jurors not to bring in an open verdict, so they decided Calvi had committed suicide. His wife felt this was an unacceptable decision, so she applied to the High Court for a second inquest. This time the jury reached an open verdict, meaning Calvi might have committed suicide, but might have been murdered.
This removes the stigma over my father's name. We think that the jury has done the best on the evidence, and it's very difficult to bring the whole picture into a coroner's court. And also,
The whole picture would have involved revealing Calvi's secret membership of an Italian Masonic lodge. This wasn't mentioned to the jurors who visited Blackfriars Bridge during the inquest, but 6 months later, the foreman said that had they known about Calvi's Masonic connections, they would have reached a homicide verdict. Some Italian reporters thought there had been a cover-up.
There was a wish to not to create a big scandal. There was a wish to keep things under cover, and you can imagine anything you want. You may even imagine that they wanted to protect something.
Last January, three Italian judges decided Calvi had been murdered. They were convinced by reconstructions of his death under Blackfriars Bridge, enacted 5 years later on nights with similar tides. They felt a man of Calvi's age and physical condition could not have climbed the scaffolding, especially without leaving any trace of rust on his hands, whereas he could easily have been strung up from a boat. But why would Masons have wanted to kill Calvi? Why is it even relevant to look for Masonic symbols in his death? The reason why lies in a police raid 15 months earlier on the properties of an obscure mattress manufacturer in Arezzo, Tuscany. His name was Licio Gelli. The police seized thousands of documents relating to a Masonic lodge called P2, which almost no one outside Freemasonry knew anything about. What shocked the police were the names on a list of 980 members. There were dozens of leading Italian businessmen and industrialists, and the police chiefs of Italy's four biggest cities, a total of 43 MPs, including the ministers of justice and foreign trade. There were 51 generals and admirals, and the heads of all Italy's secret services. Together, these men operated like a private government, manipulating one of Europe's biggest democracies. Leading bankers like Calvi completed the list.
When the Italian government gave out publicly the list of the P2, we were astonished. It was like discovering that Italian democracy was something else from what we had always believed. We saw that there was another something going on underneath the surface of events. And so we asked ourselves why.
The answer goes back to a bitter struggle between Freemasons and the Catholic Church in Italy, which has lasted ever since English gentlemen and sea captains introduced the Brotherhood here in the 1730s. The Church soon branded Freemasonry the work of the devil and excommunicated all Catholic Masons. Italian Freemasonry turned anti-Catholic and revolutionary and went underground. It has had a clandestine and persecuted history ever since. The Grand Orient is Italian Freemasonry's ruling body.
Contrary to what happens in England and America, where the state not only tolerates Freemasonry, but recognizes it, here state and church don't recognize it, but even condemn it without knowing it.
In 1926, Italy's dictator Mussolini banned Freemasonry. After World War II, it was made legal again, and an old secret elite lodge was reborn as Propaganda Due, or P2. This failed to recruit many members, until the Grand Master at the time asked Licio Gelli to take over in 1970. Gelli immediately set about changing the character of P2. Tonight, he speaks out in defense of his lodge.
Militavano nella P2 i migliori uomini.
Inside the P2 lodge, we had the top men Italy had in all fields, in the world of politics, in diplomacy, the top men from industry, the press, the law, and the civil service. They were all the very best. By joining P2, they wanted peace and tranquility within the lodge, so that they could all contribute in their own fields to the betterment of society.
L'uno sia l'altro. Per poter migliorare la società.
Gelli initiated his P2 elite in a suite in Rome's Excelsior Hotel, not in a Masonic temple. It never met like a conventional lodge. Instead, select groups of members plotted to control the state, as agendas seized at Gelli's premises revealed.
The political and economic situation of Italy, the threat of the Italian Communist Party, aiming at the conquest of power,
the spread of immorality, indiscipline, relationships with the Italian state.
We were striving for the improvement of society, to make a contribution, to safeguard the democratic institutions of our country. This was P2.
But in the 1930s and 40s, when Mussolini ruled Italy, Gelli was a dedicated fascist, and he's never been a friend of democracy. After the war, he fled to South America. He returned in the 1960s, when he was wealthy, respectable, and an ideal Masonic recruit.
I felt Masonry was the university where one went to learn rules of right and wrong and graduated with a degree in morals, sound principles, and ethics. These were the only reasons I joined the Masons, and I joined them again. I have been a Mason, I am a Mason, and I shall behave all my life as a Mason.
He's a man that likes darkness, he's a man that likes intrigue, he's a man that says that likes democracy but has a very strange idea of democracy. He comes from the extreme right. I don't think he has ever left that position. His friends are still the same fascists that he met with during the war.
After the raid on Gelli's villa and the exposure of P2, it became clear that the main aim of the lodge was to subvert democracy. An exhaustive parliamentary inquiry found that P2 was a state within a state, a cell of extreme right-wingers bent on maintaining power by ruthless means. For example, in 1978, Italy's Christian Democrat Prime Minister, Aldo Moro, favoured bringing the communists into government in a plan known as the Historic Compromise. But then, Moro's car was ambushed and he was kidnapped by left-wing terrorists. Evidence which later emerged suggested that the longer Moro was held captive, the better it suited the P2 Masons who headed the secret services.
Chi avrebbe dovuto trovare Aldo Moro?
A committee drawn up from the staff of the Interior Ministry was put in charge of finding Moro. They were nearly all P2 men. Later, I was on the Moro inquiry. I read all the documents, the few there were from that committee, and I must say, dispassionately, that they had no intention of finding Moro. To leave Moro in the hands of the terrorists, to let the situation rot, was a sure way to make sure that the historic compromise did not come to fruition.
Three months after Moro's kidnap, he was found dead in the boot of a car. His body bore the marks of repeated torture. But Italy's body politic had also been mutilated, and the communists have been shut out of government ever since. According to the Italian Parliament's report, P2 members, in a black propaganda campaign, also planned or backed grotesque acts of terror, including one of Europe's worst terrorist crimes. In 1980, a bomb blew up in Bologna station, killing 85 people. To discredit the communists, this was made to look like an act of left-wing terror, but it was committed by fascists.
The massacre, according to the High Court of Bologna, was committed by some subversive neo-fascist individuals. But it's also a fact that a near-permanent contact was established between right-wing subversive elements, the P2 Lodge, and the men of P2.
Today, under the nervous protection of armed police, Gelli is at liberty in his magnificent home in Tuscany. While not directly involved in the Bologna bombing, this year he was convicted of covering the bomber's tracks and given a 10-year jail sentence. However, the terms of his earlier extradition from Switzerland mean he will never go to jail for the crime. But the P2 Lodge, of which he was venerable master, has also been implicated in allegations that in London, Roberto Calvi suffered a ritual Masonic murder.
Roberto told me that Little Gelli, a lot of time, told him that for people who betrayed the Freemasonry, there was the death. And he was really scared.
As head of Italy's largest private bank, Roberto Calvi was a valuable target for recruitment into P2, which he joined in 1977. His Masonic sponsor was none other than Licio Gelli. But it's alleged Gelli and his P2 friends soon set about looting Calvi's Banco Ambrosiano. In one of the world's biggest financial scandals, the bank's debts rapidly exceeded its assets by £1,000 million, so Calvi was under severe financial pressure. By 1982, the Vatican Bank was demanding the return of £200 million of its money, which Calvi had diverted for the benefit of Licio Gelli and the P2 group. Much of it was meant to be used to further the P2 plot to control Italian politics by buying Italy's largest newspaper empire, Rizzoli. But the money had disappeared overseas. Calvi was also under pressure from the law. His appeal against his currency conviction was about to be heard. If it failed, he would go to jail. And the Bank of Italy was after him about dozens of shadowy banking operations he had set up outside Italy. In June 1982, Calvi fled to London on a false passport. But why he came is still a mystery. He may have hoped to pressure his debtors, but the men who had smuggled him out of Italy, who had got him the false passport, had their own reasons for getting him to London. It was a place where they had strong criminal connections.
We know that the man that accompanied my father to London had the boss contacts with the underworld in London and with Masonry in Italy. We know that they had contacts with the group that was specialized in laundering money that was coming both from common crimes and right-wing terrorism.
So if Calvi was threatening to expose the men who had looted his bank, London was probably a most dangerous place for him to do it. Significantly, most of the documents which he brought to London in his briefcase disappeared. Francesco Siniscalchi is the Italian Mason who first exposed Gelli and P2. He believes Calvi died because of what he was threatening to reveal.
It's my opinion. He had documents with his in his hand suitcase, which has not been found completely, to show that he could blackmail in some way people there. And when someone is using this type of means, of course he risks his life.
If you have a secret you must tell today, if you say tomorrow I will talk, you are destroyed. They kill you. You must speak before, not say I have secrets of yours and I will tell tomorrow.
Whatever secrets Roberto was threatening to reveal in London, he telephoned his wife 2 days before he died to say he was on the verge of solving all his problems.
He told me, it is happening something wonderful that will change all our life, because it was near to make the deal.
And he thought he could make this deal
in London.
Oh, yes,
he was so happy. He said, something that will change all our life. So I was full of joy, you know.
The joy was short-lived. Roberto was found dead 2 days later. The Calvis suspect London underworld figures could easily have killed him at the request of their Italian associates. But now, with a cast of suspects that includes criminals, terrorists, bankers, politicians, and even priests, where does the allegation that he was murdered by Freemasons fit in?
Many of the theories that exist around my father's death and the theory of a Masonic plot or a Masonic execution are not necessarily mutually exclusive. That can very well coexist. Some of these individuals, they may have been criminals or politicians or businessmen or even priests, and also have been Masons. And in fact, in some cases, we know that they were.
P2 master Licio Gelli will soon stand trial in Italy, charged with fraud on Calvi's bank. It may be to his advantage that Calvi is not alive to give evidence, but he denies any involvement in Calvi's death. Indeed, Gelli was on the run in South America at the time, and he claims great affection for the banker.
You know, I too would like to know how Roberto Calvi died, especially because he was a very dear friend of mine, a true friend, besides having a very good head for business. But I haven't got a crystal ball, and if I had, I wouldn't know how to consult it or read it. It's a question I can't answer.
By the time Calvi died, the Grand Orient of Italy had expelled Gelli and disbanded his P2 lodge on the grounds that it was a perversion of Freemasonry. But in fact, Gelli and his lodge had merely taken to extremes Italian Freemasonry's centuries-old custom of secretly interfering with the nation's destiny.
Nella memoria storica della massoneria.
There remains in the tradition of Italian Masonry this great need for privacy and secrecy. During this century, we have been persecuted by fascism and Nazism. Therefore, in our country, Masons have always had to plot a little against the state.
Un po' a complottare contro lo Stato.
English Freemasonry has a strict policy of not interfering in politics. That's why it had always refused to recognize Italian Freemasonry with its highly political tradition. But in 1972, England's Masonic bosses had a change of heart and recognized their Italian brethren. Ironically, the man who had helped negotiate England's recognition of Italy's Masons was Licio Gelli, the closest confidant of an earlier Italian Grand Master.
Gran Maestro Salvini ottenemmo il riconoscimento.
Grand Master Salvini and I finally obtained the recognition of the Mother Lodge of England. I think that this was one of the greatest satisfactions which P2 Lodge and those who belonged to it ever had.
Determinante in questo caso, determinante con tutti gli uomini che aveva.
No sooner had Gelli helped bring the two countries' Masons together than England's Masonic leaders went to Italy and mixed unwittingly with the underworld of the city of Florence. In 1973, England's then Grand Secretary, James Stubbs, visited Florence to consecrate an English-speaking lodge. He was welcomed by leading members of P2, including a close friend of Gelli's named Alessandro Del Bene. They honored Stubbs with a banquet in Del Bene's mansion. Unknown to Stubbs, his host was an illegal arms dealer, known in the Italian underworld as the Godfather of Florence. But Gelli claims he met an even more important English Freemason in the 1970s.
Le regole della massoneria.
One rule we have in Freemasonry is not to disclose the names of other Freemasons, but I'll make an exception. I know one, and I'll tell you about him, the Duke of Kent. I don't know if you know him. I met him when he came to Florence. It was a great moment when the Grand Master and I shared the ceremonial embrace with the Duke to celebrate the recognition of Italian Masonry at that time by the Mother Lodge of England. I met him in Florence and we had lunch together.
The Duke of Kent is Grand Master of English Freemasonry. He says, to his knowledge, he has never met any Italian brethren at a Masonic function in Florence, and while he has met a number of Italians over the years, none of them, to his recollection, has declared himself to be a Mason. Someone who certainly met Licio Gelli was Roberto Calvi. Today, Calvi's family in Canada are still pursuing his killers. At first, Clara was in favor of her husband becoming a Mason. Little did she know, this might be the death of him.
When he joined the Freemasonry, I didn't think that it was a wrong thing to do. Because I remember that my mother always spoke very well about Freemasonry with respect. So I thought it was a good idea. It was a protection. But one day I knew, of course, about all these things that could be Freemasonry symbol. They killed Roberto, but they signed the death, the murder, no?
Thank you.
my hand...
That my hand...
Given to a master mason...
Given to a master mason...
Shall be a sure pledge of brotherhood. Shall
be a this sure is a reconstruction of Freemasonry's strongest oath of brotherhood, the so-called Five Points of Fellowship. It is this secretly sworn vow which most worries the critics of Freemasonry.
To unite with his informing...
A column of mutual defense and support.
A column of mutual defense and support.
There's no question that you can create a kind of bonding out of which comes a loyalty and obedience, in which the person just doesn't think for themselves, or doesn't behave as they would if you got them on their own, away from this influence.
They have an oath of loyalty one to another to protect brother Freemasons. My own experience as a result of what has happened to me in the last 6.5 years is that Freemasonry is an exclusive and secretive subculture of self-interest within the police service and within all bodies in which it takes root.
There is continuing concern over the power and secret dealings of Freemasons in political and public service institutions like local government and the police. It's not just non-Masons who are worried. At the Brotherhood's grassroots, many Master Masons are deeply disturbed by evidence of corruption and the abuse of patronage by wayward brethren. They believe it's time Grand Lodge put its house in order.
The men at the top are either so naive they think it doesn't exist or they're turning a blind eye to it, because there is smoke. And we've got to put out the fire.
And the vet wouldn't believe that we'd saved him. That is a rare talk. Look at him. Fit as a fiddle.
Leonard Acklam, a retired engineer from Brighouse in Yorkshire, has been a devoted Mason for over 30 years. But he's become increasingly disillusioned with the Brotherhood and now believes senior Masons are prepared to abuse their authority and cover up for each other. He's especially worried about the case of an ex-London policeman, Brian Woolard, who alleges that Freemasons have destroyed his career.
I think that Mr. Woolard should be given a full investigation as to the allegations. If he's wrong, he must stand the consequences. But if he's right, then the Masonic Order must stand the consequences. There's a right and a wrong. And the public is entitled to know who is right and who is wrong.
In 1981, Chief Inspector Brian Woolard came up against Freemasonry when he was investigating fraud involving hundreds of thousands of pounds of ratepayers' money in the London borough of Islington. Tales had been circulating that officers in the Building Works Department were authorising unjustified payments to private building companies in exchange for bribes.
The rumours that flew around at the time suggested things like holidays abroad, gifts, valuable gifts, money changing hands, excessive hospitality in West End nightclubs, these sorts of things.
At 123 Sussex Way, the borough had paid £2,300 for a new roof. But when the council auditors checked, they discovered that contractors hadn't done the work. Here at 53 Kingsdown Road, two separate firms of builders were both paid for the same renovation job, while at 25 Landseer Road, builders were paid four times as much as the original contract price. The Evening Standard exposed the scandal, and Islington called in the fraud squad. But the police inquiry made little progress until 9 months later, when Chief Inspector Woolard took over. He received a tip-off that a contractor getting a lot of work from Islington and a senior council officer handing out the contracts were Masonic brothers in the same lodge.
The Masonic element of the inquiry and the connections between officials and others in that inquiry was something that was relatively new.
But as soon as Woolard began to probe Masonic connections between the suspects, his inquiries attracted unexpected attention.
Within a short time, telephone calls were received at my office, one from the principal contractor who was under suspicion, and another from an official at the Director of Public Prosecution's office.
The DPP official was no less than Assistant Deputy Director Richard Thomas. As Woolard had never heard from any public prosecution official before this, he thought it most odd that he should hear from one now. Woolard suspected Thomas was a Mason and that his phone call had been prompted by one of the Masons already under suspicion.
It wasn't just the fact that he telephoned me, it was the timing of his telephone call. It was so soon after I'd interviewed a senior official who was a Freemason, whose deputy within the local authority had done a bunk. He'd taken immediate leave of absence. There were certain moves taking place within that local authority, suggestive of trying to cover things up.
Willard was in a dilemma, especially now he was told that two of his fraud squad bosses were also Freemasons and in the same lodge as two of the council suspects. So instead of asking permission to question the DPP man, he ignored normal procedures and confronted Richard Thomas without seeking higher authority.
My main concern was what prompted him to telephone me, and at the end of the interview, he said that he may have received a phone call from outside, which caused him to ring me at that particular time. And this is what I suspected all along.
Willard promptly reported to Scotland Yard and then to the Fraud Squad headquarters that he had just interviewed the DPP official. Within hours, he was removed from the Islington inquiry on the grounds that he had ignored the chain of command. Many observers believe there were other reasons for his removal.
There's no doubt that Brian Bullard's first troubles arose through Masonic interference in his investigation. He was looking at corruption in a London Borough Council. He found evidence, and I'm convinced he found evidence, that contracts were being awarded on a Masonic basis. When he bought this, or when he tried to investigate this, he was taken off the inquiry.
Without Willard, the Fraud Squad failed to find any evidence connecting Freemasonry with corruption at Islington Council. In due course, the Islington Inquiry report came back from the DPP's office and was marked no further action. But further action would be taken against Brian Willard.
I seem to have become overnight a non-person. I was stuck in an office where I spent 5 weeks reading library books. Eventually, I was summoned to the office of a Deputy Assistant Commissioner, Ronald Steventon, whom I subsequently discovered was a Freemason. He told me that I was not a fit person to be employed in a specialist department in plain clothes, and that I was going to be transferred to the uniform branch. I asked him if anybody had made any complaint, and he said that I had caused embarrassment.
Willard was posted to Wembley Police Station as a uniform chief inspector. Until his stand over Islington, he'd been regarded as a high flyer. He'd served for 22 years in plain clothes and had been a special branch officer on royal protection duties at Buckingham Palace, guarding cabinet ministers and gaining glowing testimonials when he later joined the anti-terrorist squad and the CID. But his first annual report at Wembley catalogued a startling decline.
He is completely unsuited to this very responsible post. He has no incentive, and I consider it very unlikely that he will make any greater efforts.
All my reports since 1982 have been by senior officers who are Freemasons. And the first two were so scurrilous, I have never seen the like of them given to any police officer in my entire police service. So from one moment when I was considered to be a high flyer and a good officer, and the next day I was a non-person and a police officer who had not the wit to hold down his job even.
Early in 1984, a few details of Willard's case surfaced in Private Eye and The Observer, and he was rapped over the knuckles for speaking to the press. But the stories revived fears about Masonry's disproportionate strength among Britain's police forces. Eventually, Metropolitan Commissioner Sir Kenneth Newman was forced to intervene in the growing row. In 1985, he compiled a booklet, The Principles of Policing, for distribution to every one of London's 28,000 police officers. It laid down guidelines on the role of the police in the community. But in a long section on Freemasonry, the advice was pointed.
The discerning officer will probably consider it wise to forego the prospect of pleasure and social advantage in Freemasonry, so as to enjoy the unreserved regard of all those around him.
As far as the principles of policing are concerned, the book, the idea was very, very sound, and still is sound. But that particular chapter that picks on Freemasonry, I thought was unfair. A, it wasn't discussed properly and at length, and B, it singled out one organisation that has proved itself time and time again to be an excellent organisation with all good intentions that all citizens should aim for.
Although the booklet carried all the authority of London's chief policeman, Commissioner Newman's advice was not compulsory. Indeed, a few months later, many high-ranking officers chose to flout it. In 1986, a new all-police lodge was formed, in itself proof of Freemasonry's remarkable strength in the Metropolitan Force. Lodges restricted to one job or profession are not normally allowed in Freemasonry, yet the founder members of the new Manor of St. James's Lodge were almost all past and present policemen, and included some of Scotland Yard's highest-ranking officers. The former chief of all London's 3,000 detectives, Gilbert Kellan, the then commander of the fraud branch, Malcolm Campbell, and one-time Deputy Assistant Commissioner, Peter Nevins.
Well, the founders were faced with a very difficult situation because, in fact, they were putting this lodge together before the publication of the Principles of Policing. And they were faced with a difficult problem. Do they now abandon the idea and be seen to be cowards in the face of what might have been opposition?
The Principles of Policing could be seen as a threat to the power of Freemasonry and the police force, but it may also have been seen as a challenge to the very power of Freemasonry itself. Certainly, the consecration of the Manor of St. James Lodge, which took place here in Freemasons Hall, was not only sanctioned by Grand Lodge, but actively blessed by the presence of some of the craft's highest officers, including Grand Secretary Commander Higham. The danger in a large single profession lodge like the Manor of St. James is that it could bond together senior and influential figures working within a single public body, in this case the Metropolitan Police, all pledged to mutual support.
The grip or token is the first of the 5 points of fellowship. They are hand to hand, foot to foot, knee to knee, breast to breast, and hand over back, and may thus be briefly explained. Hand to hand, I greet you as a brother. Foot to foot, I support you in all your laudable undertakings. Knee to knee, the posture of my daily supplications shall remind me of your wants. Breast to breast, your lawful secrets, when entrusted to me, as such, I will keep as my own. Hand over back, I will support your character in your absence as in your presence. It is in this position.
The thought of public figures like policemen, judges, and even cabinet ministers undergoing rituals like this strikes many people as bizarre. For others like Brian Woolard, it is sinister. But Freemasons see it differently.
It's a form of symbolism. They're all symbolic. And to us, they are important in the sense that you do what you do in the group of people that you can trust and that you respect, and they in turn respect you.
But ultimately, it's not the secrecy or symbolism in Freemasonry's rituals which is important. It's the secrecy of so much of its membership.
A lot of Masons make no secret about their allegiances. And they call themselves Knife and Fork Masons because they go along for the social life. But unfortunately, there are a group, and it must be a substantial group, who are unwilling to reveal their identity, who are in positions of power, and who, whether they use their influence or not, must arouse the suspicion in the public mind that anything that they get involved in is not dealt with correctly.
Just occasionally, that secrecy is breached, and Masonic documents come to light. 5 years after Brian Woolard had been banished to Wembley, a well-wisher sent him a Manor of St. James Lodge membership list, which had been left in a squad car in a West End police station.
When I read the Manor of St. James Lodge list, I was so surprised to see so many officers who had had some influence over my career, all in the same lodge. I mean, to find one or two might have been suggestive that it was a coincidence, but to find so many, one after another.
The list revealed that Manor Masons were especially thick on the ground at Wembley. They included three founders of the lodge. The commander of Kew District, which included Wembley, William Gibson. His deputy, Chief Superintendent Ben Pountain. And Edgar Maybanks, Kew District's Deputy Assistant Commissioner.
I was in a sort of Masonic soup bowl, if you like, and I couldn't get out of it. There was no way out, because any complaint I made would have to go through the chain of command. So the very officers against whom I was complaining would somehow make decisions relating to any report that I submitted and would put whatever comments they chose on those reports.
One of those officers was co-founder of the Manor of St. James Lodge, Commander Gibson.
Woolard was the chief inspector under my command for some time, so I know the circumstances as well as anyone, if not better, and I've got no sympathy with Woolard and his views whatsoever. He's a very articulate, possible gentleman.
I cannot see that there is any credible evidence to support an allegation that Freemasonry has banded together to form a conspiracy against the individual. Whatever these officers were doing, they were doing as police officers, not as Freemasons.
The Manor Lodge list might not convince Masonic policemen of the need for an inquiry, but many non-Masons find it persuasive evidence in support of Brian Woolard's claim that his career has been wrecked by Masons in the Metropolitan Police. Among those who believe his case should be investigated is Labour MP Austin Mitchell.
What irks me is the fact that there's no way of taking it up. We've taken this, first of all, to the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, from him to the Home Secretary. In each case, it's been referred back down to the people against whom complaint has been made in the first place. And there's no way of getting an independent review of this matter.
England's Masonic chiefs have taken the view that Woolard's claims are without substance. But Freemason Leonard Acklam is unconvinced by head office denials. He read of Woolard's case in the national press, and although he was concerned about the damage it was doing to Freemasonry, he was not prepared to see it swept under the Masonic carpet.
Now, Mr. Woolard has got sacked. To the best of my knowledge, no investigation has ever been taking place. Here is a man who has got promoted, one must presume, by his own initiative and his own efforts and his dedication to the job. And he rises to a very high rank in the Metropolitan Police and all of a sudden he's a poor policeman. I just don't believe it. I cannot believe it.
In 1988, Scotland Yard dismissed Brian Woolard for going absent without leave. In fact, he had medical backing for not going to work unless he was assured that he would not be serving under a Masonic boss. But although his career is finished, Brian Woolard hasn't given up. 8 years after he was taken off the Islington inquiry, he's still fighting to get what he has sought for so long, a High Court review of his case or a hearing for wrongful dismissal.
I believe that my case will show, when it's examined dispassionately in a court of law, that there are influences there which can interfere with adequate redress. There are influences there which can lead to the destruction of an officer's career. There are influences there which can hinder the proper investigation of offences. And if those influences are shown to be active within the police force still, then I think that is a very, very serious matter indeed.
The Masonic dimensions to Brian Woolard's story have become clear only through his professional persistence and the carelessness of St. James Freemasons leaving lodge lists in police cars. In most of the cases we've investigated in this series, it's largely through chance that Freemasonry's role has emerged at all. How many Masonic groups in other walks of life are still unknown because the relevant lodge lists remain secret. Recently, non-Masons in politics, the civil service and local government have demanded that Masons should declare their membership of the Brotherhood. After a recent Masonic scandal in Southend, a then-Conservative councillor, Chris Hudson, called for a register of all Masonic councillors, but the motion was voted down.
That in itself is not bad, but the people who voted against its being carried through were possibly themselves Masons. So therefore we had people sitting in judgment on themselves. So unless we have a declaration of who are Masons, we're never going to be able to see the picture developed. We've just got a hazy negative of what's going on.
In Rochford, Essex, there was uproar when opposition councillors recently named members of the ruling Conservative group as Freemasons. Why did most of the Masons refuse to declare themselves?
That is essentially up to other members of the Rochford Council, whether or not they declare their Freemasonry. I think that many of them feel that exactly what I do, that it was an impertinence to ask them to do this. Next thing we shall be asked is how many times a week we beat our wife.
In Derbyshire, declaration of Masonic membership became an issue after the truth leaked out about the power wielded by local Freemasons. For more than 30 years, they've held some of the most influential jobs in county government. Since 1987, county council employees have been required to declare whether they are Freemasons, a reform introduced by the ruling Labour group.
I don't want to come across here as being someone sort of anti-Masonry, because I'm not. What I'm anti is their influence. If people want to gather together and do those things, I think that's entirely a matter for them. But I would think it's in their interest to be turned around and say, look, let's throw open our meetings. Let's go the way that most public organisations are going and saying, OK, let people come in who are observers. Let the TV cameras go into one of their meetings and see these rituals and take that secrecy away of it, because I'm sure there are many people who want to be in the Masons, they enjoy it, they've got a contribution to make, they like to do good charity work, and are probably offended by some of the comments that are made elsewhere. The answer is open the doors.
In recent years, the Grand Lodge of England has opened its doors, but has rejected demands that it should publish its membership lists. Most Masons argue that compulsory declaration of their membership would be an infringement of their civil liberties, a witch hunt.
There's no reason to conceal it from anybody, but where are you going to draw the line? I mean, I don't think any of us have the least hesitation in, if we're asked in a relevant context, of saying, yes, we are. We're not on the defensive, it's not an admission, we're proud of it. But I do query the sense of the public trying to pick on one group and say, now you've got to declare. It's strange. It's not a very attractive approach of one half of the community to another.
It may not be attractive, but most of the 200 MPs who responded to a recent survey believe that politicians and other public office holders should declare their Masonic ties.
We have to declare, for instance, whether we're company directors, whether we're directors of this dodgy building company or that failing travel company or this consultancy or whatever, why shouldn't we have to declare something else which can also influence our behaviour? And that should go for judges, it should go for council officials, it should go for people in a position of trust and responsibility, and that includes senior policemen. I'm not against Freemasonry, I'm all in favour of harmless activities like that, and nobody would want to stop people belonging, but those who belong should have the courage of their rather blood-curdling convictions and declare it.
Public declaration could even help Freemasonry. Remove the secrecy of membership and the possibility of Masonic corruption would be reduced. Once a year, the Masons of Melrose in Scotland march through the town square, so every member of the lodge is known to all the townspeople. Perhaps the rest of Britain's Masons should come out of their closets and march openly through the streets, if they've nothing to hide.